This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, well, we're starting to get back organized after the hurricane here in Florida, and I missed a lot of programs, so I'm happy to be back. And I am so happy that my guest today is somebody, well, I love art, I love Michigan, and so I was so thrilled when I got this book. It is called Attribution, and it is by Linda Moore. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Patsy. All good thoughts to folks in Florida from San Diego. Hope you all are doing much better.
Well, yeah, it didn't hit our area. We were in the Target, and we prepared for a week, and then it hit further south. But yes, you're right. Everybody's prayers are with these people, and we're doing a great job here, trying to get people back and up and running. But I was so happy that I didn't have to cancel this program because I love this book. It is called Attribution. When I got it, I said to myself, oh my goodness, this is exactly the kind of book I knew I'd like because I love art and I'm a little bit of an artist myself, not like you and all the people, you know, and works that you've seen, but I just wanted to talk to you. And tell us about your exciting life. I mean, you are an amazing, you have an amazing career, and now you've turned it into this story, which I think is so good. I don't normally mention to people, you know, I don't think I have ever mentioned the star ratings that people get for their books. This is the first time, but I saw so many 5 stars for you, and it is well deserved because it's just great. I love Kate Adamson. I think you've come out with a great character. But first, tell a little bit about you, because there's a reason you could write such a great book about art.
Well, thank you, Patsy. I spent a long time researching this book, and frankly, it was a pleasure, because I love all these stories about art. And I think sometimes we are too into the technical parts and not into the lives of the artists, who are real people with challenges and some of them all kinds of crazy bits and pieces of their life. And I find all of that fascinating. And I think this idea of a hidden painting was always riveting. And now that I've written the book, I can't tell you how many emails and phone calls and notes I get from people who have had an experience finding a painting, or they know about one, or they send me news stories. And so this idea that you can go to the Goodwill in Texas and buy a Roman head for $32 that's from 2BC is a pretty exciting scavenger hunt, right?
Oh, I have done it for years. I always go to secondhand bookstores and secondhand stores, and I dig around always hoping, and I've found a few really wonderful pieces. So yeah, it's really exciting, and it's sort of there's this treasure hunting thing that we all have, you know, from a young age. And so you just hit everything right with this book.
Thank you. I didn't really answer your question about me. I call myself a recovering gallery owner, and I did have a gallery gallery, and actually I loved it, but you know, gallery like writing is it's a tough business. And I mostly represented artists from the southern cone of South America, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, some Colombian, and I love that part of the world, and I had a great time. So forget the business. I had fun. And writing is turning out to be a lot of fun too. So it's work, and as your listeners probably know, that takes a long time to write a novel or any book. And so you have to believe in it, you have to love it, and stay with it.
Well, there's so many things in this book I love. Of course, I've been to the Prado. I lived in England, and so my husband and I spent a great deal of time driving through Europe and going to Europe. And so, you know, I've been through Spain. I've been through the Prado. I just love art. And as I said, I'm a little bit of an artist myself. And so you just hit it right. Tell us about this story. Tell us about Kate. And I think it's so clever.
Oh, thank you. Well, Kate is a Midwest girl like me. I was born in Wisconsin.
And I'm Michigan. I'm a Michigander.
And you're Michigan. And my son, I was so excited from California that one of my children decided to go to university in the Midwest. And he is, you're probably going to be a Sparty fan, but he went to U of Michigan. And he actually played football there, but that's another story. And so I became a big Michigan fan. I was going back and forth to the games, and I really, really loved the idea of you know, the Midwest and all those values that I have, that I feel the solid, you know, feet on the ground kinds of people that grow up there have. And I wanted to use that in the book, but also the contrast of what it's like. And you left there. If you went on to London and stuff, it's, you know, the world is different in other places. Fitting in is, you know, always on the mind of everyone who moves around and travels. And I think that is a challenge for Kate, who is also dealing with the loss of her brother. Younger brother, and her parents' grief. They don't seem to be able to get past it. And part of it's that they put all their hopes on a boy in the family, and she's the girl to a brother and a sister. So she goes on to New York to finish her doctorate in art history. And there, it gets worse. She meets an impossible professor who's not even sure he wants her in the program. And he signs her busy work to do the inventory in the basement. And she's poking around, and she finds a hidden canvas in a trunk, a chest in the basement. And she believes it can be something. And that launches her journey into a long, winding path to try to figure out who painted this painting, why it was in such an odd place. And hopefully with that research, make a career for herself and finally convince her professor she's got what it takes. And that is the story of Kate.
And, you know, I one of the things when I think of, first of all, I will tell you that I was in the marching band, and so I played in the marching band, University of Michigan, many times.
Oh, go blue!
Go blue, go blue for sure. And so, and half the girls in Michigan dream about going to New York and working either in publishing or in the art world.
Isn't that something? I totally understand that. And you must know many people. So I hope that Kate came up to the standard of what a Michigan girl going to New York looks like.
Well, absolutely. That's why I loved it so much. I mean, just for that, I loved it. Wherever she went. And then, well, to find this painting. Now, tell us about the painting. Because, you know, you write so well. You I always tell people, paint a picture. And in this case, we have a picture here, and you've painted it. With every location, you make us feel like we are in that location, and that is really a great talent.
When I was in university, I took my junior year abroad, and I studied in Madrid. So the idea of a young person in Madrid was, you know, part of my history, and I love Spain. I've been back. I was trying to figure out the other day how many times. But I also felt it was a special challenge to talk about a visual media art in with the written word. And I there are people who have asked me if I have a picture of this painting she found. And of course, it's a fictional painting. But it actually occurred to me that maybe I should ask one of my artists to try to see if he can draw out of the book enough of what I described to make a painting. I wonder what it would look like. But in any case, it was a lot of fun, and being able to transfer not only the actual visual content, but the whole sense and essence of an artist, that was a big challenge. And I'm glad that you enjoyed it, because it means a lot to me that people who love art love the book, and people who don't know about art love the book and maybe begin to take an interest in art.
Exactly. Well, tell us about the artist that you selected, because I think that's a perfect artist to make a really enchanting story about.
Well, I actually should give a shout out to friend who was a young curator, and I heard him talk in a lecture at the San Diego Museum of Art about a painting he was trying to attribute and all the challenges he faced, and not just the technical history and research and chemical tests and all those things, but then the whole political world of people whose reputations are made or broken on their attribution of certain works. You may have seen a story that came out recently in the New York Times and a variety. It was in a variety of places.
The Vermeer?
In our local. The Vermeer.
My
in
God.
Washington City.
I went crazy when I, as a matter of fact, I had already read your book, and I read that, and I said, oh my goodness, I wonder what Linda thinks about it, because this is amazing.
So many emails from people saying, did you see this? Did you see this? And one of my things that is really come out, grown out of this, is the idea of how many women hundreds of years ago made wonderful art. And we have never heard their names. We don't know anything about them. And one of the stories that has been published in scholarly journals, and there was even a scholarly panel about it not too long ago, is that Vermeer's daughter Maria painted about 20% of his works. And part of it was because when he died, his widow and his daughter family were poor. And they needed to sell, quote-unquote, Vermeers. And it may have been that she finished some paintings, that she created others. She always worked with her father in the studio. So Maria's story is like, oh, my gosh, I'm itching to see if maybe there's another novel there.
Because I'll tell you one thing. Years ago, the first time I saw Girl with a Flute by Vermeer, as I looked at it, I didn't think it was a Vermeer. I didn't have that tingle.
That is called, the fancy word for that is connoisseurship. So experts in art, especially old school experts, rely very heavily on their eye. That is something. So like, you know, and this is part of the debate and dilemma. And of course, wonderful for writers, because it opens the door to possibility to imagine different ideas and results. But the The idea of connoisseurship is that you can look at a painting with an experienced eye and be able to tell a lot. And that's what you just described. Something's just not right. And the article did, and the people at the National Gallery, as far as I know, did not conjecture that the Vermeer might have been by Maria.
No.
But they say someone close, they did say someone close to Vermeer. So I am just itching to know more. I'll let you know if I find out anything.
Well, good, because, probably there's going to be a lot of books now about it. But I'll tell you, I when I went to high school, well, I didn't go to high school. I went to high school, but I skipped, I would say, 70% of my classes. And I spent my entire high school years in the Detroit Museum of Art, which is a fantastic museum.
Oh, my God. I know it well. I love that wonderful Diego Rivera mural.
Yeah, you know, I spent really almost 4 years there, at least 3 days a week, because I did not have to go to high school because I had already read all the books and I didn't need it. But
oh yes.
So when I saw that painting, I knew it was not a Vermeer. I knew it. I just knew it in my heart, and I just knew it. And so that's why when I got your book, because as I said, I get excited about it. And there you're talking about Vasquez. Tell us about. You know, why?
Well, Velasquez was an interesting.
Yeah.
He was born in Seville, and his family had sort of a semi-noble connection to Portugal, although there's a lot of sketchy stories about their background. Anyway, he was born in Seville, and from an early age, his father thought that he had some ability to paint. So they put him with one tutor, and he quickly surpassed what he could offer. And then they put him with an important tutor named Pacheco. And Pacheco was kind of a star in Seville at the time. Velasquez was maybe 12 years old when he went into to be sort of a studio assistant, mixing paints and organizing the canvases and so on. And he in those times, people were told exactly how to paint things. So if a church ordered the Virgin, a painting of the Virgin, they knew they were getting a Virgin with 12 stars over her head, with her feet standing on an orb, and, you know, drapes of blue around her, and very rigid. Well, Velasquez quickly departed from that into something called the Bodegon paintings, the bars and cafes and restaurants with real people in them, and they are just stunning. Look at the water droplets on those jars. Oh my gosh. And so he had made a little bit of a name for himself. He ended up marrying Pacheco's daughter, and then was getting commissions of his own, and was noticed by the Count Duke of Olivares, who was from nearby. And the Count Duke of Olivares was, at that time, the prime minister, if you will, to the young King Philip IV in Madrid. And the King of Spain was the king of an empire that included the Netherlands, Milan, and Naples, as well as all of South America. So the year is around 1620 when Velasquez goes to Madrid. And he makes a sample painting, so to speak, a portrait of the king. And the king declares when he sees the portrait, "This is my court painter. No other shall paint my portrait." So Velasquez then moves to Madrid with his young wife and takes up quarters in the royal palace at age 23.
Wow.
Can you imagine? Now, I know what I was like. Kate's 23 also. Remember that in the book. And so I love his story. And, of course, many, many of his paintings, which were extraordinary. He went to Italy twice. A lot of things happened and changed when he went to Italy. I don't want to give away too much.
Yeah, no, don't give away the stuff. But it's fascinating.
But one of the things about him is that his work stayed hidden until the early 1800s in the royal quarters in Madrid. So a lot of people didn't see them. But when they did, wow. And part of that was when the Prado, which was a natural science museum, actually they started hanging paintings there for the public to see. And Manet came from Paris, and he declared Velázquez the greatest painter of all time. And there are many who say the first Impressionism ideas came from Velázquez. So there's a lot. He is no doubt one of the most important painters of all history. And I'm happy to write about him because everyone's writing about the Italian artist in fiction. And I thought, it's time to put Spain front and center. So that's part of my journey.
And the gorgeous museum, it takes your breath away. the art, you know, it just, whew.
So I love Kate's dad, who's a blue-collar auto worker in Michigan. And he says to her, looking at art is no kind of work. And she later in the story, she's sitting there in that amazing rotunda in the Prado, and she says in her head to herself, Dad was right. Looking at art is not work.
It's not. Oh, and the funny thing, so many people don't know his name, although they've seen his work represented in so many places. When you actually go and look at it, somehow people didn't pick up on this name. And you're right. I'm glad that you did Spain. I think it's wonderful. I hope it will open people's eyes. And, you know, when people are thinking about making a trip to Europe, I think going to Seville and Madrid, absolutely, I had a fabulous time in both places.
No doubt about it. I have been to Spain many, many times, and it never gets old. My husband and I chose to spend a big anniversary in Seville, and it has all the elements of being so accessible and fun, and walking the cobblestones where you know Velázquez put his feet down, and so did Columbus. And being able to see all of that history that still feels alive. But at the same time, the people are so friendly and open. You'll have five friends before you leave any bar.
One of the things they say about a book is when it's really good and you really love it, you're sad when you get to the end and you say, oh, that's too short. And that's how I felt. I mean, you just... One wonderful thing about this book, the pacing is terrific. It just flows so nicely, and you build up the excitement and the intrigue and the love story, and of course, what comes through is the love of art. And I was so happy that I just got a kick out of this book.
Well, thank you, Patsy. I am really, today is my pub day.
I know.
So Attribution is out in the world. And to hear you say that, and also I have a lot of emails from people who have read early copies and tell me, I lost a whole night of sleep because of you. I couldn't put it down. I couldn't quit until I knew what happened. And I love that, too. I guess I don't love that they lost sleep, but I am excited that the book, especially, there was always the danger that it might, I might get bogged down. And I do feel sometimes when I go to art lectures that art historians have the need to tell you everything they know. And I was trying to tell you enough to keep you interested and to understand. But not overwhelmed with all the, many details and other detours.
Well,
about
you have accomplished it. You have accomplished it. You tell us. You really make it intriguing. You make it fun. It's a memorable story. I love Kate. And I think it's just wonderful. I don't know if Kate's coming back, and you know, I can have more stories about Kate, by the way. And I just want to tell people, one, get Attribution. It is a wonderful book, really wonderful book. For me, it was a delightful afternoon. I remember just sitting there, and it was getting towards sunset when I finished. And you're right. You couldn't put it down. It's a wonderful book. You have a very nice website. I hope people will go to it. Lovely photographs there. And it is just lindamoreauthor.com. lindamoreauthor.com. Your website, I think it's a beautiful thing. And lots of praise. Lots of praise for the book. I think you've hit it out of the ballpark. I always think of the Tigers when I think of Michigan. And, you know, they may not be the best, but they do know how to hit it out the ballpark sometimes. And you certainly have here. And it's wonderful to talk to somebody who has Michigan in it, art in it. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you again so much. And I'll close with a little Michigan story. I insisted that my son go get a membership at the university's art gallery while he was playing football there. And I said, you've got to go see this exhibit or that exhibit. He said, I've already been, Mom. Oh, my, be still my part. And he said, yeah, the weight coach, whose name was a guy named Mike Gittleson, and that's the guy everybody on the team hates because he makes you work out so hard. He assigned the entire Michigan football team to go to the university art gallery and realize that their university was more than football. And if they didn't go, they were going to get an extra workout. So I love that guy, and I love Michigan football. And don't everybody in Ohio can still buy the book. Please.
All over. But everybody should buy the book. It's wonderful. Attribution by Linda Moore. It's a terrific book. And just congratulations on this. I think you are a fantastic writer.
Thank you, Patsy. And thank you for your support.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Okay, we're going to do a book buzz from Devon Miller. It's a very nice one and timely. So let's go ahead with that.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Tock Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Last month, Hurricane Ian made landfall in the Sunshine State of Florida, which meant that so many theme parks containing roller coasters were shut down. Now that Ian is gone, theme parks featuring roller coasters are back open to the public. And now that they're open, I know the Pigeon is certainly going to ride on them. Yes, the Pigeon, one of the characters created by children's author and illustrator Mo Willems. The Pigeon makes a return in the book, The Pigeon Will Ride the Roller Coaster, written and illustrated by Mo Willems. Mo Willems isn't a big fan of roller coasters, but the last couple of years for him learning to adapt was a real roller coaster for him. It eventually turned into the idea of The Pigeon Will Ride the Roller Coaster. Fasten your seatbelts for an emotional story full of twists, turns, and loop-de-loops as the Pigeon will be ready to ride the roller coaster. The question is, will you be ready? I think after reading this book, you'll certainly find me ready to ride along with the Pigeon. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's book buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
Commercials. Let's go to commercials. And then we'll... Oh!
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with Howard Yanus. Is Howard there?
He's right here.
Hi, Howard Yarus. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay, Howard. I'm going to read the title of this book, Understandable Economics. Because understanding our economy is easier than you think, and more important than you know. Oh, Howard. I love the
it
name.
It really is.
Oh, Howard. I love the name, Howard. Does anybody understand anything anymore? Oh, maybe
well,
you do.
Well, you know, to have a complete understanding is almost impossible. In physics and biology, you can study and research and experiment and come to some clear truths. Economics, it's a social science. It's like psychology. Does a psychiatrist ever fully understand his or her patient? Absolutely not. But do they understand enough to help them? Yes. And that's what we need to do with the economy. We need to understand it well enough so that we can make improvements.
Okay, Howard. Oh, boy. I love you. Because you have a heck of a job here to convince people that anything makes sense nowadays. When you go into the grocery store and you look at a box of cereal and they want $6.50 for it, the world's going crazy and economic understanding is like, I don't know.
Well, inflation is at a relative high. When I was a kid, it was high and then it was very low for a long time and now it's come back. And people are not happy about it. And if they want to do something about it, if they want to see something improve, they're going to have to learn more about what it is, because you can't improve a system you don't understand. Actually, that was the original subtitle for the book. If you can't improve a system you don't understand, people can vote for Donald Trump or join Occupy Wall Street or vote for the Tea Party. What good has that resulted in? Not much. People need to learn more about the economy so that they can figure out what policies would actually help and which policies are useless.
Okay. So,
It's a big job.
Big job. Tell me the five policies that would help right now.
Well, the Fed is trying to slow spending down. Again, when we have inflation, people are bidding up prices, and if people cut down on their spending, price increases will slow down. So that's one thing the Fed is trying to do. But the best way to slow down price increases is by having the economy produce more stuff.
Oh.
The more stuff, the more products we make, the more cars we put out, and the more homes we build, the cheaper things get, because there's just more stuff for the amount of demand that the economy has. It'll cause prices to reduce. Anytime there's a lot of stuff around, prices drop. So that's the best policy that the government could have to make the economy more productive and reduce inflation. And I think we really need to focus on that, because we have a lot of headwinds. We have the war in Ukraine. We have COVID. We have climate change. So the government, if there's one thing, the one thing that the government should be doing is trying to allow the economy to produce more. That's my biggest suggestion, my biggest hope.
Yeah, but if everything costs so much to make,
it costs a lot to make, but to the extent we have more immigrants, for instance, we'll have more labor to produce things, and the more, again, you talked about cereal costing a lot of money. To the extent that they're able to produce more boxes of cereal, and there's more and more of a back supply of cereal, prices will come down. That's the best way to lower prices, to have the economy produce more stuff, so prices come down. It all comes down to supply and demand.
Look, I know it sounds like that, and I'm trying to get my head around it, because at one point in my life, I owned 8 stores. I had a franchise company. I owned a company, and then I franchised.
What kind of stores?
So I had 8 stores. And then I actually landed up opening a factory to produce. It was a confectionery store, so I opened a factory to produce the confectionery. Now, I know if I was doing that today, I would be, it would be insane, because the cost of pistachios and almonds and walnuts, they've gone up. I couldn't afford to make the chocolates and all of the nut products that I made today. I would go crazy.
Right, but on the other hand, if somehow they could increase the supply of all those nut products and all the other things, it would be cheaper for you to produce.
But it's finite.
I don't know how much cheaper, but it would be cheaper. And that's what the government has to do. It has to make it cheaper and easier for people like you to produce things.
But how does it make? Like, it was a confectionery store, primarily fruits and nuts. Now, when I needed walnuts and I needed pistachios, and this was in England, so I imported everything from America. They all mostly came from California. Now, I
Sounds
needed
expensive.
Them. I desperately needed them, okay? And when I got today, I could not afford it, because the farmers are charging so much, because the water costs so much and the electricity costs so much. And it doesn't matter that in California they have labor that costs nothing, that they really, it's ridiculous that they don't pay the labor. So where are you going to fix it? What step along the line can you fix this?
Okay, there's one step: electricity. Why is electricity expensive? Because we don't have adequate infrastructure to provide regular and abundant electricity. Maybe we should invest more in electric power plants so electricity dropped in price. It all comes down to supply and demand. If electricity is reliable and abundant, the price is going to fall. If it's not reliable and scarce, the price is going to go up. That's one step the government could take to reduce the cost of producing goods and services.
Okay, so how are they going
to... You can't solve all the problems. You know, I'm on my local community board, and I use this line all the time. The perfect should not be the enemy of the good. To the extent the government can reduce some prices, it can't solve everything, but it could take steps to make people's lives better, more productive, and richer. And that's what it should do.
But this is like a really vicious circle. This is like tigers.
Not really. To the extent your pistachio expenses or walnut expenses didn't go down, but all of your other expenses went down.
Maybe you
could produce a little more.
No, if the walnut and pistachio prices don't go down, I could not be producing the product. So, and when you talk, if it's, there's so many things that impact here, the prices. So,
right.
I don't know what anybody is going to do here, because it is, in California, it is very much the water, it is very much the electricity, and they are not going to go down because, I don't know, the whole system is broken.
Well, somehow we managed to produce $22 trillion a year of goods and services. So I don't know how you can claim a system that turns out $22 trillion a year of goods and services, creating the greatest wealth literally in the history of mankind, is broken.
But if I can't afford a box of cereal at $6.50, my fruit and nut products were expensive because they were top quality. Today, mm-hmm. I could not... A box of the same fruit and nut that I was selling would sell for normally, say, $20. A fancy box of would be $40 today, because I watch the prices. It's sort of a habit, you know. I check the prices of fruits and nuts.
Absolutely, some things have gotten more expensive. The fact is, the vast majority of Americans are not going hungry. If you look at something like computers, they've plummeted in price. Televisions plummeted in price. Yes, some foodstuffs have gone up in price. The point I'm making is that we are a rich country, and we could take steps to make marginal improvements, small improvements in people's lives. It's not a broken system. $22 trillion a year is a lot of stuff. It's the most stuff literally in the history of mankind. You know, I make the point in Understandable Economics that before 1800, almost everyone was food insecure. That's hardly the case in America. The vast majority of Americans are far from food insecure. They have adequate food, they have housing, they have clothes to wear. The economy is producing a lot, and the whole goal of the book is not to say it's all broken, forget it, we have to throw it away, we have to vote for Donald Trump, we have to join Occupy Wall Street, we have to vote for the Tea Party. It's to make life better in small ways, if not big ones. And to say we throw up our hands, everything is terrible, and this is the worst thing, it's just not right.
Okay, so how...
It's not correct.
It's not correct. Okay. So what...
Did you have food for breakfast? Did you have something to eat today?
You have to remember, I've lived all over the world. I've lived in some of the poorest countries in the world. So I know all about poverty. I know all about living on the edge. I've traveled to these countries.
And those people still have better and richer lives than the average people in Europe and the United States more than 200 years ago. Mankind has been getting richer and richer and richer every decade.
So, we're talking here about improving things. How can we improve? Well, what do you want? What do you think needs to be improved?
I think we need to make better investments in our infrastructure. You mentioned electricity; it's expensive. To the extent you build more power plants, electricity prices come down. It just gets cheaper.
What kind of power plants?
I'm not an expert on energy creation, but whatever it takes to increase the reliability and quantity of electricity, that's a specialized expertise. I don't have it, but I know society makes investments that produce electric power plants, and they should do it, whatever it takes. That's an engineering question, not an economic question. I just know that to the extent we have more energy and we have more electric plants and more reliable energy, the price of energy is going to come down. That's undeniable.
Okay. So when this book, should young people read this book? Should 18-year-olds be reading this book and getting some sort, both a personal understanding of their own economic situation and the country's economic situation?
Yes. Yes to everything. The point I always make is if the Supreme Court made a decision that threw hundreds of thousands of people out of jobs, you would not hear the end of it. You would hear, people would not stop talking about it. But the point is the Fed makes decisions all the time that throw hundreds of thousands of people out of jobs. They made a decision a few weeks ago to raise interest rates, which cuts spending and reduces job opportunities. People need to focus on what's going on, because you've expressed the frustration very well in this conversation. And the only way we're going to improve the system, a system, by the way, that is working. We had our food today. We're in a building safe from the elements. The only way we're going to make it even better is to learn about the economy and try to support policies that would improve things. I gave you one example. Better infrastructure so businesses can produce goods and services more easily and cheaply. No, the price of pistachios and walnuts may not go down, but maybe the price of transporting the goods or the price of the electricity can come down. There's no perfect solution to everything, but there are ways we can make our economy better, and I think we should focus on those.
Well, of course, like when we talk about infrastructure, it's very nice if it gets done. Unfortunately, yeah. Having, as I said, lived abroad, and particularly in Europe, where we have trains, we're running all the time. You could get on a train and go anywhere in Europe, and boompity-boomp, it didn't cost very much, and you could get any place fast. Yet today, it's interesting, I discovered that a trip from Victoria, Texas, to Austin, Texas, by Greyhound bus, takes 11 hours, because that's what they do nowadays. And a flight, they've canceled most of the flights out of Victoria, and so everything is so messed up. At some point, I suppose it comes down to, as you said, the people that are in power, maybe you should send this to everybody in Congress. This is a wonderful book. I mean, it's fascinating. It is a great read. You know, a lot of books about the economy wouldn't be as interesting. You're a good writer, and you really
I really appreciate that, because you're a good reader. I read on your website how many books you read, yeah. So that's a real compliment coming from you.
Well, thank you, because I mean I think it is an important book, and I wish particularly young people, they are so. I mean, they know nothing. I mean, when you see those, they ask questions on the street, and these young people don't know, you know, when the Revolutionary War was or where certain countries are. I mean, they're ignorant. They're completely ignorant.
Well, what the Revolutionary War was
Basically,
it's a blank slate for many of them.
They don't know it. So I don't know how we can get this in their hands, but I wish and I hope that people will wake up and learn about the economy. And if you're going to learn about the economy, understandable economics. Whoa, because understanding our economy is easier than you think. And
right, you can't give up is my bottom line.
Yeah, maybe.
We have a system that is doing well by historical standards, and my hope is that we make it better. That's what I would like to leave you with.
Well, that's a hope. Unfortunately, you know, I also do on this program. I interviewed a lot of so many writers who write fantasy, and it feels sometimes like I'm in a fantasy world here. But I do hope that people will get your book. It is an important subject, and you're a fine writer. As I said, you make it easy to read. It is an easy-to-read book, and lots and lots of stuff. I like the private sector and the stock market, because a lot of people are worried about their finances in the future. That's a great one.
Mm-hmm.
I also like when you write about the people and about, we get to the nitty-gritty, the government, and their role in doing things better. So a wonderful book, Understandable Economics, and I think you've done a great job. Do you have a website, Howard?
Yeah, it's my name, Howard Yarus, HOWARDYARUSS.com.
Okay, Howard. Well, I think you're... You're a man with hope. And
I definitely am with hope.
And that's what we need, Howard. It was great talking
to
you.
Okay. Yes, thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Okay, go to his website, get his book. I'm like going crazy. I'm telling you people, this is nuts. This world is nuts right now. Please, if anybody wants to know how crazy it is, you have to read that article about why the French company pulled out of doing the high-speed rail from San Francisco to Los Angeles. I mean, that should be an easy thing. It's really ridiculous. And the billions of dollars that they're spending on that. So, I don't know, people. You do have to know what you're doing, and you do have to know something about economics. So I hope that, think about it. But I do, again, want to thank so much. I really so enjoyed talking, about the Prada, about the museum, and Velazquez. And I hope that if you haven't ever looked at anything by Velazquez, just Google it and look at the paintings. And when you're thinking about a vacation someday when we can afford to travel again, a trip to Madrid is quite, it's breathtaking to go to the Prada. So anyway, that was one of the places that we used to drive to in our white Cadillac. I can tell you, when we arrived in Seville in our white Cadillac, everybody was watching us. They just loved it. They got such a kick out of a white Cadillac in Seville. So, that was lots and lots of fun. Oh, wow. Again, I want to remind everyone, I've got a couple of very important dates coming up. October 25th is the Carol J. Perry Day here on Joy on Paper. And then October 27th is going to be the Jack Reacher Day. And Lee Child and his brother, Andrew Child, Andrew Grant, as we know him here, they are going to be on to talk about the latest Jack Reacher, which is very exciting. And so, lots of great things happening. And if you have a question or a suggestion, send me an email, patsy.radio@gmail.com, and I would love to hear from you because I have some interesting things coming up. And go to my website, radio-joyonpaper, because I have also some interesting stuff up there for you. I'm going to have a contest I want to tell you about soon. Okay, everyone, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry and one of her series. I don't care which one they do, Haunted Haven, her new one, or Witch City Mysteries, because they're both great, and she deserves to have it on television because she's a great writer. And it's going to be her day here on Joy on Paper, October 25th. And I'll say something nice to be getting in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Bye-bye now. He saluted me because I should have been a general. Oh, my goodness, I would have been the best general of all. Okay, bye-bye now.